Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 131 of season 11 of Mover. I'm in at the Daily Podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and no one is joining me once again today because this will be my third and final episode going solo. Hopefully, you all have been enjoying my commentary without having a guest. Be rest assured that for the rest of the season, I will be back with guests. The conversations flow much better when there's more than one of us. But you know, sometimes you just do what you gotta do. Episode 131 begins with Winters being a little confused and ends with Spears wanting the gun. So we left things off in the last episode with Janovic getting killed in the car accident, and Webster made a comment about the fact that he had 75 points, and Winters looks at him and goes, "What?" And he goes, "He was 10 points short." So it's a very somber moment. You know, we get to see a dead, thin Tom Hardy. You know, died in a way that hopefully would have been avoidable, but unfortunately wasn't. Webster then helps put the body into the ambulance. And then we see Winters driving on, you know, at night in his Jeep. Winters looks very deep in thought, trying to think about what's been going on. He starts with narration. He goes, "The enemy had surrendered, but somehow men were still dying. Young men who wanted to be home with their families by now, who had served with distinction since before Normandy, were stuck here because they didn't have the points. What they did have plenty of were weapons, alcohol, and too much time on their hands." Which is a great introduction to the next that we're going to be dealing with. So there's a Jeep that passes by Winters, and you know, Winters salutes them back, and then the camera continues with them. And we see that Grant is there, and he goes, "Honest." When all of a sudden, from out of nowhere, a guy jumps out of the hedge grove onto this guy's chest, shoves a trench knife up against his throat, and screams, "Whose side are you on?" And I don't get it. It's D-Day. Right. Second Platoon's own Bill Garnier, old Garnier himself, just landed in Normandy and wound up, I don't know what. "Whose side are you on?" What a f***ing character. And then the guy next to him goes, what happened to him?" And he says, "Got his leg blown off in Bastogne." And, you know, as they're driving along, so Sergeant Grant sees another Jeep just on the ground, just stopped. There's, like, three vehicles that are sitting around there, and something's a little suspicious. You know, not really sure what's going on. And Grant then takes charge of the situation and says, "Wait here." You know, he's going to go see what's going on. That you know, that's good for the position that he has. And he sees a soldier, very inebriated, staggering back and forth. We see another soldier lying on the ground. And as Grant gets closer, he goes, "Are you okay, Mac? Need some help?" And the man just starts laughing. And he goes, "They wouldn't give me any gas." You know, we can see that he's carrying a pistol, and we see some bodies on the ground in German uniforms. And he goes, "Krauts." And he goes, "I tried to explain." And then he points to another body on the ground and he goes, "This f***ing limey wouldn't listen either. I think he was a major." And Grant looks at him and goes, "Private, we've got a problem here." The GI then looks at him and goes, "Do you have any gas?" And Grant goes, "Well," he starts moving towards him slowly. He goes, "Why don't you give me your weapon?" "Well, I guess I'll just use his Jeep. I don't think he's going to be needing it." And he starts walking towards one of the other Jeeps to take it. And Grant goes, "Hold on a second, all right?" The guy just gets into the Jeep and goes, "Jesus." And then he just picks up the gun and shoots Grant right in the head. And Grant falls right down. Now, I mean, this is a very tragic story, this whole thing of everything that happens here. And it's completely amazing the way that it's shown here, because it's a pretty short vignette in the book itself, but it's a powerful one the way that they show it to us here, because they do expand on it. So I mean, when I get to the end, so I'll talk about what the book says. But for the time being, you know, we see that Grant gets shot, and the two guys in his Jeep jump up and go, Sergeant Grant, Sarge, and you know, these guys don't know what to do, because the guy who shot him just backs up and drives away. And then we're in a medical room, or it looks like a makeshift doctor's office. And the doctor then says he's not going to make it. And Spears says to him, "You can't operate him on it. Not me. You need a brain surgeon. And even if you had one, I don't think there's any hope." Spears then turns to the guys around him and goes, "You find the shooter. I want him alive." And then he points to one of the other guys. "Come on, help me." And Talbert goes, "What are you doing?" Says, "We're going to go find a brain surgeon." And Talbert then starts walking by. They pass by Liebgott, and he goes, "Hey, Lieb, he wants a NOMCOM guarding each roadblock with at least two men watching every road in the town. Bull, Malark, you each take a squad. And one of these witnesses on a house-to-house search. Do we shoot this bastard on sight? That's malarkey. Tower goes, try and take him alive. And Bull says, where's Grant now? Tower says, took him to a crowded hospital. If they can drum up some good doctors. So, again, this is a great way to show that, the Army doctor, he could be anything. Again, I'm not belittling Army doctors or anything like that, but, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's a surgeon. He could be, for all intents and purposes, just a dermatologist. I don't know. But doesn't do surgery. But, he's been drafted, and he's the doctor, and he's the one who has to deal with what needs to be dealt with. But, he can't do brain surgery, from that perspective. I mean, one of the great things is you have Doc Rowe here also, and Doc Rowe is holding a bottle of plasma that is, via IV is, being put into Grant as they're trying to deal with it. And again, it's also great how all of the men seem to have just woken up. These guys are not in full gear. Some of them are in t-shirts and stuff like that. It's okay. Now we're going to go on this manhunt to try and find this guy who shot Grant. Let's figure out who it is. And then we hear a knock on a glass door, and we hear some dogs barking, and then a gun taps on the window. We hear Spears on the other side say, "Open up!" And the occupant of the house looks through the curtain to see who it is, and Spears just points the gun right at him. Says, "Open up! Come with me!" And the surgeon says, "Why?" He goes, "Get in the jeep." He goes, "Where are we going?" "Get in the hospital." "Where are we going? Where are we going?" "To the hospital. Get in." So the guy puts on his robe and a scarf and moves forward towards the jeep. And he says, "If you're going to shoot me, shoot me. If you're not, put the gun away." And Spears gets a little more fierce and says, "Get in the jeep now." And the surgeon looks over at the stretcher that has Grant on it and goes, "What happened to him?" And Doc Rowe says, "He was shot in the head a half hour ago," Spears says. "Come on." And the surgeon then looks at him and goes, "If you wanted to live, you'll help me first by putting that away. Come on, let's go." And the surgeon gets into the jeep and says, "Let me drive. We'll get there faster." So again, I like the way that this is portrayed. We'll shortly talk about what it talks about in the book. But the idea that here you have a surgeon who, despite the fact that he was on the German side during the war, he still, abides by the Hippocratic Oath and wants to do whatever he can in order to save Grant's life. It could be from the perspective of a challenge. Sometimes, there are surgeons that want, as anyone who's seen ER and Chicago Hope and Grey's Anatomy and all those things, the brain surgeons are the ones who always want to do these special things where they, because of their God complex of being able to fix anything, that type of thing. But who knows? It could just be that this is a guy that, is seriously interested in helping out someone like Grant. Again, I don't know the extent of it all, whether this is truly something that the regimental doctor or whoever it was, wasn't able to deal with. How intricate and is this type of surgery? I don't know. I mean, obviously it's brain surgery, so it makes things a little more complicated. Then the shot changes and we see two guys playing cards. And in the background, you hear a lot of sounds. You hear a thud, you hear someone scream. At this point, we hear Liebgott say, "Come on, get him up." And someone else says, "Jesus." And, we see that we're dealing with Talbert and Luz, who are playing cards. And Talbert goes, "Again, what a hand." He goes, "I wonder who's taking a bigger beating, me or him?" And he turns to Luz and goes, "You want to play a different game?" And he goes, "No, same game. You're shuffling up good." And in the background, we hear Liebgott beating the guy up. And you hear him say, "That's it." And, these guys just aren't able to keep playing cards. It's something that for obvious reasons, it is very distracting, and it makes sense. So it made me think about playing cards. When cards were actually first created, I know we've touched upon this in the past, but I figured I'd still go back into it again. So in China, that's where they first started with card games back in the 9th century. And then in Egypt in the 13th and 14th century, they were introduced during the Mamluk Empire. and they decided to add the idea of four suits. You had the polo sticks, coins, swords, and cups. And then in the 14th century, the European traders and returning crusaders adopted this kind of Mamluk card. And the earliest recording in Europe is in 1371 in Catalonia, Spain. There is people who had cards there at the time. In the 1480s, so the French decided to standardize and streamline the suits. They made them what we're aware of these days, of spades, clubs, hearts, and diamonds. At this point, they also added the idea of a queen into the thing. And in the 19th century, they added new innovations, including corner indices, you know, so that you can see in the corner what card and what suit you're dealing with. And they also added the idea of the Joker. The whole idea of a Joker card is that it was a card that basically could just, trump any other card. But there are games that don't use Jokers. So you have like games like poker and blackjack and things like that. It's usually a wild card. So sometimes you have it in Rummy or Canasta or a game called Chase the Joker, where it's able to basically substitute any other card. The idea that a Joker card can take over for anything else. Actually, in the 1880s, that's when the idea of having two Jokers in a standard 52-card deck, so making it a 54-card deck with the whole thing, because you have Ace through King along the way. It's interesting that that's the way that they decided to modernize the whole thing. But I was even more curious about the fact of how they jumped from the idea of polo sticks, coins, swords, and cups to what we use nowadays, the diamonds, spades, hearts, and clubs. So basically, the coins became diamonds, and they were originally represented as bells in Germany and diamonds in France, basically symbolizing the wealthy merchant class. The swords eventually became spades, and in the Italian and Spanish decks, they actually keep the swords there. French changed the shape a little bit and eventually created the symbol that we're aware of today, which is a pike head, which is called a spade. Cups eventually became hearts, and the idea of a religious chalice or cup was changed into a heart, which symbolizes the idea of clergy, with the sword and spade obviously referring to the military or defending oneself type of thing. And then you have the polo sticks, which became clubs because Europeans themselves didn't play polo, and they mistook the shapes for batons or clubs and things like that. And then it was changed into the clover leaf, and the English then named it clubs. The Mamluk prints, from the beginning were hand painted, and were difficult to copy and make them. And when they started mass producing them, so they decided to use the idea of making them red and black, because those are colors that are easy to reproduce. And this basically helped make the French suits become the global standard along the way. But so Talbert and Luz are a little distracted by the whole thing, but they decide that they're going to keep going through it. And, Talbert keeps looking back, and Luz says, "Are you all right?" And he goes, "Yeah, I'm all right." And he goes, "You want to go in there and join in?" We hear someone scream, "Come on, get him up." Talbert goes, "I should go in there and stop this." We hear someone else say, "Like that, yeah." And Luz then says to Floyd, he goes, "Floyd, let's just play cards, all right?" And, as they're sitting there waiting, so Spears comes into the room. Spears goes, "Where is he?" And Talbert says, "How's Grant?" And Spears says, "Where is he?" And Talbert goes, "Is he okay?" Spears goes, "Where is he?" He then goes right into the room. It shouldn't be that difficult to find it, where you have a ring of men standing around this guy beating the crap out of him. Not too difficult to figure that out. And we see this guy is completely bloodied. And Spears goes, "Is this him?" And the man is just bloody to a pulp. And Bull goes, "That's him. Replacement. Eye Company." And Spears looks at the guy and says, "Where's the weapon?" And that's how things end, because we're going to wait until tomorrow's episode to find out what exactly this guy's answer is going to be. So the book, as I said before, simplifies the story here, but it still is quite impactful. Again, I think in the visual context of the series, it is more powerful. I think that's what it comes down to. So on page 236 of the book, it says, Sergeant Chuck Grant, an original Tacoma man, was a smiling, athletic, fair-haired Californian who was universally respected. He'd knocked out an 88 in Holland, and like one night he was driving a couple of privates to a roadblock for a change of the guard. As they arrived, they saw a commotion. A drunken GI was standing with a pistol in his hand, two dead Germans at his feet. He stopped them in the vehicle and demanded gasoline as he was out, but he had no German. They had no English. He concluded they were resisting and shot them. A British major from military intelligence happened to have been driving by. He and his sergeant got out of the Jeep to see what was going on. The drunken GI pointed his pistol at them and told them to back off. At that moment, Grant came driving past. The drunk took a shot at him but missed. The major made a move to disarm the man. The GI turned on him and shot him dead. Then a sergeant. Grant came running over. The drunk shot him in the brain, then ran off. Spears thought the world of Grant. When he heard of the shooting, he and Lieutenant Foley jumped in a Jeep, drove to the site, got Grant on the stretcher, and rode off for the regimental aid station. The doctor there was a disgrace, unshaven, unkempt, wearing a badly stained shirt. He took a quick look at Grant and said, "There's no hope." "Bullshit," said Spears, put Grant back on the stretcher, and rode off again, this time for a South Sudan. Spears had heard that there were some German specialists there. One of them was a brain surgeon, was a brain specialist from Berlin. He operated immediately and saved Grant's life. Word of the shooting flashed through the bullets. E Company went out en masse to find the culprit. He was found trying to rape an Austrian girl in Zellemzam. He was a recent replacement of Company I. To the express disgust of many of them, he was brought back to the Company HQ alive. He almost wished he hadn't been. Half the company was milling around him, threatening, kicking, swearing vengeance. Before anything more serious could happen, Spears came rushing in straight from the hospital. "Where's the weapon?" Spears shouted at the prisoner. So I'll continue reading about that tomorrow, explaining about what the response is going to be here. But again, this guy deserved everything that he got from the men of Easy. At that point, that's where we end today's episode. Thursday, I discussed the whole idea of why I decided to talk about Band of Brothers this season. And then on Friday, I had a conversation with you all about my history with Band of Brothers. And so today I actually wanted to talk about something a little different. I want to talk about the reasons and the insights that I've gotten by doing something a little different this season. This season, one of the things that I did, and I'm sure most of you who are listening have noticed this, is I did 21 interviews over the course of the season. Now, it's been a known thing over the years with Movies by Minute podcasts that people try as hard as possible to get people connected to the production to be on their shows. Now, there are certain people like Jim O'Kane with his shows. What he does is he finds people that he sometimes has someone who has a very small bit part. He's able to try and track him down and get that person to talk about their experience, which I always find so amazing. I mean, recently on his Captain America podcast, the Minute by Minute podcast, he got like the little kid who was thrown into the water by the German operative in Brooklyn. So, you know, like little things like that, where here it's, you know, was it 15 years later, and he's able to still interview somebody about his experiences at that time. So it was something that was always a goal of mine through the course of doing this entire series of trying to find people that are connected to production to be able to talk to them about their experiences and things like that. I mean, if you go all the way back to The Great Escape, so The Great Escape, my first season, I actually was able to get two people to interview. One of them was David McCollum, who was part of the cast. I got to him through one of my guests who happened to recently interview him for something else, and he was able to give me his phone number, and it was I think I had an hour to prepare in order to be able to call him up and do a phone interview with him, which I'm very grateful. Stephen J. Rubin and David McCollum at the time for giving me so much insight about, you know, a movie that was made 63 years ago, but it was I think 59 years at the time. Maybe 58, something like that. And then later on in that season, I also was able to interview Christoph Epstein, who did a documentary about The Great Escape, which was also really fascinating. It was a little strange for me because he's not an English speaker, so I was debating whether I need to try and get someone to translate and whatever. In the end, his English was good enough, and you can go back and listen to that episode also if you want. Now, the big one that I tried getting for The Great Escape was Quentin Tarantino. I happened to be at a film festival that summer when I was recording the show, and Tarantino, who sometimes part of his time lives here in Israel, was one of the guests of honor at this film festival. So I went to a showing where he was introducing a film. He was introducing the film, I think it was called The Ambassador, with Robert Mitchum. Pretty sure that's the one that it was. You know, I placed myself in a position where I would be able to try to go over and talk to him. And when they were rushing him, he actually sat, I think, like three rows in front of me while we were watching the movie. And right when the credits started rolling, he got up with his entourage and was getting ready to leave. And I followed him out. You know, I stayed close to him and I said, I really enjoy your work. And I know that you're a big fan of The Great Escape. And I would love it if I could interview you for it. And he looked at me and goes, well, thank you, but I don't think that's going to work out. And I give him a lot of credit for the whole thing. I mean, one of the big problems that a lot of us have over the is the idea that we think that people who are celebrities should be on a higher level or something like that. And the bottom line is they're people too. They're people who made decisions and got to a certain point in their life where they're obviously well-known, where they're, I guess, famous, where they're making more money, things like that. But the bottom line is when you break it all down, it's basically they're people too. So, you know, I was very grateful at the time for Tarantino that he responded this way, because he really could have been a real ass. He could have just said, no, get away from me, stop bothering me, or something like that. And he didn't. You know, he was gracious about the whole thing. Again, I was very disappointed that he didn't agree to join me on my show, but still, it still worked out quite well. And then I left the whole idea of interviews on the side for many, many seasons. Planes, Trains, Automobiles, I didn't try and get anyone. Die Hard, I didn't try and get anybody. When Harry Met Sally, I sent out a few feelers. I sent a feeler out to Rob Reiner, rest his soul, and he didn't respond to me at that point. I'm trying to think if there was anybody else from Harry Met Sally that I tried to get in touch with. I don't remember at this point. Then when Die Hard 2 came out, when I was working on Die Hard 2, I went and got in touch with a lot of the cast members, and not a single one of them responded. I know that I wrote to William Sadler, and I wrote to a lot of the bad guys. I wrote to Reginald Bell Johnson. Nobody responded whatsoever. So I said, okay, well, you know, who wants to be on this little minute-by-minute podcast? So I understand, you know, that people also, when you do have some sort of fame, you don't necessarily, you're not going to answer every single person that is going to reach out to you. For obvious reasons, you don't know who they are, you don't know who you're getting in touch with, you don't know whether these people are normal or not. So it makes sense. So I, you know, didn't do anything after that. When it came to It's a Wonderful Life, there unfortunately wasn't anybody to really get in touch with, because everyone has already passed, because the movie came out in 1946. So I was talking with Joe Amade, who's a friend of the show, and Joe, who was the one, I forgot to mention this before, he was the one who actually got me in touch with Christoph Espenon back with The Great Escape, because Joe himself is a big Great Escape fan. So Joe actually got me in touch with Donna Reed's daughter, and I interviewed her for It's a Wonderful Life. And I really enjoyed that, because I was a little trepidatious at the beginning, because here I'm going to talk to a child of someone who's in the movie. Like, what are they really going to be able to help add to the whole story? And we had such a great conversation. I steered away from things dealing with family, you know, about the, like, what was it like growing up in a house with a famous person and things like that. But the conversation was really, really fun and enjoyable. And most importantly, it was fascinating, because I was learning so much more about Donna Reed's career and her life and things like that. And obviously her legacy, which is also very important. And then season 7, when I got to Die Hard with a Vengeance, I didn't have anyone that I was able to get in touch with. I mean, I wrote to a few people. I remember writing to the writer. He didn't respond. I wrote to some other people in production. None of them responded. So once again, that was something that just fell on the side. When it came to Saving Private Ryan, So someone gave me the idea. I don't remember even who gave me the idea. It might have even been a friend of the show, Jake Hood, where the idea was, is okay, well, why don't I try and get in touch with some people for Saving Private Ryan to try and find a way to get more insight into stuff that went on during the production of the movie itself. And in the end, through my various connections, I got in touch, first of all, with George Les Jr., who that was through Chris Henry of the Apollo 13 Minute, and another good friend of the show. So Chris got me in touch with George, and I had a great conversation with George about Saving Private Ryan, about Band of Brothers, about his father, who was one of the Band of Brothers. We talked for over an hour. The episode itself, after edited, is nearly an hour about the whole thing. We talked about the Nylund brothers, who were the inspiration for the brothers of Saving Private Ryan. And it went really well. And then after that, I was in touch with someone who did various interviews during the course of I think he said it was for Showtime. A guy named Christopher Ward. I got in touch with him. He was doing publicity interviews with the cast, so he was able to talk to me also and give me insight about that. I got in touch with Bill Kimberlin, who was one of the special effects guys from ILM, who told me some really, really fascinating stories about things that happened in ILM, both while making Saving Private Ryan and throughout his career of working on at ILM, which this is a guy who knows George Lucas really well. So it was great talking to him. And then I was trying to find someone else to talk to. Once again, Joe Amedee was the one who came through for me. And he got me in touch with a documentarian, another friend of the show now, Christian Taylor. And what we basically did was Christian suggested that I get in touch, that she'll get me in touch with a World War II veteran, C.O. Bauer. So then we had a great conversation, the three of us. That's actually one of my longest episodes ever. It was over 100 minutes. It was an hour and 41 minutes interview that I did with C.O. Bauer, which was just so fascinating. First of all, I've never spoken to someone who, was over 100. There's just the conversation was just amazing, amazing. And then came Die Hard Duo. There was really nobody that I was able to try to get in touch with there. And it was also something that's a I was doing a short season anyway, so it didn't really work very well. And then for the Thinking Apollo 123, I actually got in touch. I think it was also once again via Stephen J. Rubin that I or maybe it was Joe Amedee also. I don't even remember at this point. I got in touch with the son of Walter Matthau, Charlie Matthau, and he responded to my email, but wasn't interested in doing an interview, so I wasn't able to get that interview. I started thinking about doing back Band of Brothers, and I was like, okay, we have the whole idea of the interviews with the men at the beginning of each of the episodes, plus you have the credits at the end of each of the 10 episodes. And I was like, I don't really need to talk about these things with various guests. It would make it more interesting if I were to do interviews. So I got in touch with George Les Jr., and he and I, started conversing, trying to think of different people who it would be good for me to talk to. So basically, I have pretty much three categories of people that I can that I talk to over the course of this season. I talk to family members, I talk to people on the production, including actor writers and actors, and I talk to historians. So I mean, I can break it down between the various. I'm good at talking general because I don't think I need to go into specifics because everyone here has probably listened to each of the interviews that I've already done. There's one more interview that's going to come out next week. The actor Douglas Spain, who played Tony Garcia, so you'll be able to hear that on the last day of this season. So that'll on this Friday you'll be able to hear my interview with Douglas. And the whole idea basically is that with these from the historian perspective. So I had a number of historians that I got in touch with, and what I did was is I chose different people who based on the information that I had dealt with different aspects of the history of the Menevezi, the history of World War II, and things like that, just to give a more well-rounded perspective, both for myself and for my guests, of the various things that were going on with the men in real life. Those interviews were really helpful in helping me understand what each of the what these men were basically going through while they were, whether they were, in England or whether they were going through the various battlefields across Europe and things like that. And I found that to be really, really interesting to hear those the perspective of the historians on that type of thing. Then the next group of people were the family members. So, you know, I started with George Luz Jr. himself, who started off the season. And once again, we had over an hour conversation about the various aspects of the Menevezi, the history of all the reunions, the history of his father's friendships, things like that. And it helped me to feel more connected to the characters that we've all come to know and love over the last 25 years. And I mean, here was the son of one of them who's familiar with everybody else. And from there, he got me in touch with other people who, you know, other family members. I ended up speaking also with Gene Garnier, who told me about his father. And that was also really, really interesting, hearing his perspective. Because, you know, growing up in a household where your father doesn't talk about anything that's really going on, or what that anything that went on during his service, and just learning about it once your father, at a very advanced age, becomes familiar with the world because of this book and miniseries is just great. And then I also spoke with Chris Langlois, Chris Langlois, who is the grandson of Doc Rowe. Once again, I got a lot of information about Doc Rowe, about the way that his family didn't know anything, and the journey that his family went through in order to try to find as much information about Doc Rowe as possible. And then the final people that I got in touch with were Alex Kinkala's nephews. So I spoke with Tim and Rudy. And those were also great conversations, because here you have someone who unfortunately lost his life fighting for freedom back in 1945. And, you know, his legacy is still being carried on by his nephews, who are both now, you know, in their 70s and 80s. So, you know, the old adage of, you know, as long as you're remembered by people, then you still live on. And I think that's great. And that's one of the reasons why it's also great that I have these conversations with them recorded, so that, you know, we can have them for posterity. So now the third category of people that I was able to get in touch with are people that were part of the production. I spoke with five of the actors, spoke with three of the writers, I spoke with the set director, I spoke with the production designer, I spoke with one of the producers, and again, speaking to all these different people who have different experiences when they made this miniseries helped me to really get an idea as to the vast number of people that are needed to be able to put together a movie properly, or a miniseries, or whatever, however you want to look at it. I mean, the way that each of these people spent all this time creating their aspect of this production, it's amazing to talk to these type of people who all have different aspects and different jobs within the production of a movie. Just helps show the building blocks that are needed in order to make a successful movie or miniseries, with the way that with everyone doing their part of the job and how each person's job complements the others. Now, one of the other people that I spoke with was Freddie Joe Farnsworth, who's someone who you don't normally find on a film set, but for a series like Band of Brothers, it made a lot of sense to have someone like Freddie Joe there. You know, he was one of the old guys' cadre, and they were the ones who were training the actors who were part of the production, who had prominent roles, to actually act like real soldiers and learn what it's like to be a soldier and to do what's needed, so that by the time they were on production, they were able to do things, you know, with muscle memory. It wasn't just a question of, okay, I'm an actor, I now need to learn how to shoot this gun. It's that I now know how to hold the defensive position. They've trained me to lead the men to do this and lead the men to do that. And you know, all these different aspects that normally you don't have in a movie, at least up until this point in time, you didn't have it. And then Dale Dye basically changed it. And he made the switch where now when we watch movies and we see that they have action scenes where the actors are supposed to be, soldiers, part of the whole thing is that these guys were trained in many cases by companies like Dale Dye's company or Dale's company itself, in order for them to learn how to act like real soldiers, to give us a more authentic view of the whole thing. And I just think that's completely amazing, the way that Dale Dye and his men have changed everything with the viewpoint of the whole thing. And you know, part of the people that I spoke with also were the writers. So the writers also give a different aspect of, you know, how they built the story, you know, whether they took information directly from the source, or was it just gathering source material from other people, or was it switching things around themselves in order to make it more filmable and things like that. So you know, those conversations were also just so important for learning so much about how this type of production works. So I think all in all, when I look at the various interviews that I did over the course of this season, I think it really gave me a well-rounded view of the way that stuff works in a movie. You know, this isn't something that you normally can get, where you're going to get 20, 21 different viewpoints on how to create an almost perfect movie or miniseries. But you know, for someone like me, and for you through me as a proxy, I have learned all about the way that this production works. So the big question then remains that, and after that, you'll hear this next Sunday. I have a special bonus episode where someone that I contacted when I was doing Saving Private Ryan actually got in touch with me, and I interviewed him, another one of the bit part actors from that. And he also gave me some very fascinating insights into the various aspects of the things that went on while they're making Saving Private Ryan the movie. I also neglected to mention that, you know, while I was doing Saving Private Ryan, one of the people that I got in touch with also via Kristen Taylor, she got me in touch with Corey Johnson, who was also a bit part in the movie. And, you know, the connection between Corey and then Glenn, who I interviewed next week, it will be very apparent when you listen to that episode. There's also connections with actors that I interviewed from Band of Brothers at the same time also. So it's just amazing the way that this all moves along and helps create something that's everlasting, I guess you could say. So the question now remains, okay, what am I going to do going forward? What have I learned from this process of the interviews? You know, is it something that's helpful or not? And the truth is, I think the answer is yes. I think it's been very, very helpful to me to get a better understanding of everything that's going on in a movie by talking to various people who are part of the production, whether it's behind the camera, whether it's in front of the camera and stuff like that. So I do believe that going forward, I'm going to reach out to people. I highly doubt I'm going to try to get 20 people for each season that I do. I might just get a handful, but I think that that is something that has and will enhance every one of my seasons. It gives the listener a much more interesting look at what it takes to make a movie or make a miniseries. So basically my advice to anyone out there who has a podcast and is interested in trying to figure out ways of doing interviews with people who are connected to whatever production it is that you're doing, I say go for it. Get in touch with them. Try to find ways to get in touch, whether it's IMDb Pro, whether it's via Facebook, whether it's via Twitter, Instagram. There are a lot of different options of how you can get in touch with them, because the bottom line is that you've got nothing to lose. Worst comes worst, they don't respond. And then you just move along. And you don't have to feel disappointed if they don't respond, but you will always have that opportunity that there's possibly somebody who will respond positively, and that will just make things even better for you. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So I will be back tomorrow with a guest. But until then, Creed!